Display banners or posters in your neighborhood, community, or church. Beginning Friday, June 14th, in honor of Black Fathers. More info at 202-240-1182. That's 202-240-1182 or dcblackhistory.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica bylaws amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the Pacifica.org website.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
June 11th. I'm Dave Rabin. Later in the show, we'll talk with American University historian Peter Kuznick with a counter-narrative about the recently celebrated 80th anniversary of D-Day. But first, adult attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, is one of the most common psychiatric disorders in adults, yet many healthcare providers have uneven training, to say the least, on how to evaluate it, and there are no U.S. clinical practice guidelines for diagnosing and treating patients beyond childhood. And joining us to talk about adult ADHD is Dr. David Goodman, an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We're also joined by Beverly Bryant, staff psychiatrist at the online provider Talkiatry. it's hard for me to pronounce.
Talkiatry.
There you go. Thank you. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And we really welcome callers. You know, I mean, there's a reason why I chose this topic, because I wonder about yours truly. And maybe many of you also wonder, please chime in, whether you wonder or not. Maybe you wonder about people that you're around, loved ones, neighbors, friends, whatever. 202-588-0893. So the standard definition, I guess, for adult ADHD is inattention, disorganization, hyperactivity, impulsivity. Deficit executive functioning or problems with planning, organization, and self-regulation. I think that could be said for a lot of us. Dr. Goodman, what cues you that a patient has ADHD?
Well, David, you raise an important point, because the things that you just listed off, inattention, forgetfulness, disorganization, distractibility, not being able to finish things, putting things off, is a normal human experience. And so we all have these during the course of the day, depending on our stress level, our sleep, our medications, whether we're using substances. That doesn't make the definition a diagnosis of ADHD. ADHD is anchored in childhood. You have to have had symptoms as a child that have continued throughout your whole life. So the ADHD individual says, I've been like this my entire life. The non-ADHD individual says, I'm having difficulty now, but I wasn't this way 5 years or 10 years ago. It's also highly genetic. So 80% of the cause of ADHD is genetic, which means it often runs in families. So if one family member has it, a child, then the likelihood that one of the parents has it is 40 to 50%. And I, in my practice, often treat 2, 3, 4 people within the same family with ADHD. So there's no brain scans. There's no testing for this. It really is a clinical evaluation.
Yeah. I mean, I was almost kept back. I'm not kidding when I say that there's a reason why I chose the topic. I was almost kept back in first grade because I was bouncing off the walls and not reading well. And my parents were, you know, educators, teachers, you know, reading to me all the time. You know, I assume, you know, this is 60 years ago, more than 60 years ago, I assume that I was ADHD and it wasn't diagnosed.
Well, maybe you want to get an evaluation, David. Give me a call after hours. My specialty is actually treating ADHD over the age of 50, because all of those people were never formally diagnosed, and you can still right. treat ADHD regardless of your age.
Right, right. Your thoughts, Dr. Brian, about this most important subject, this most important personal subject?
Well, I agree with Dr. Goodman. Everything that he is saying is so important, because if the onset of symptoms occurs later in life, we have to look to things like depression, anxiety, other comorbidities to explain what's going on. So the key issue is that it has to start early in life. Very important. What I would say, though, is that today, especially with the shortage of stimulant medications and everything that we're dealing with right now, there's so many challenges that have been added to trying to treat adult ADHD. And it's not a trivial thing. It's a very important diagnosis. It has a huge effect on people's lives. It's very important to diagnose and treat. And I'm so glad that you're bringing some attention to it today.
Yeah, it's great having you both. And I want you both to just chime in. You know, you're both dealing with this, I'm sure, on a ongoing basis. Just chime in. I won't necessarily know who to direct these questions to, so please chime in. I mean, it seems our culture kind of encourages it. You know, we've got emails, we've got texts, we've got phone calls, we've got Facebook, you know, checking the latest baseball score. I mean, the culture certainly seems to encourage it. Your thoughts?
If you mention culture and ADHD, it's very easy to make that connection in a fast-paced world. If you look at international research, however, whether it's in Brazil, Iran, China, Kenya, Ireland, Canada, you'll find ADHD is prevalent in all of these societies, whether the third world country or first world country. The first thing we need to do is divorce this idea that ADHD is being generated by our technology. It is not. Also, if you look at brains of ADHD individuals versus normal controls, you'll find that there are specific areas of the brain that grow differently. The neural networks attach differently. There are deficits in dopamine and dopamine receptors, which are particularly involved with motivation and cognition. So it's easy to take at face value that ADHD is nothing more than the phenomenon of high technology and distractibility. But that is just not the case when you look at the science of ADHD.
I would add that it's the frontal lobe of the brain, if you want to kind of look at this in broad terms, it's the frontal lobe in the brain that helps us to pay attention when something is really really boring. So when I'm dealing with parents and I'm dealing with adults with ADHD, it's the boring stuff that gets them. It's the frontal lobe has to engage once something becomes boring. They can pay attention if something's interesting. And so you'll hear a lot of parents say, well, it can pay attention if it's interesting, but if it's not interesting, we're lost. So that's also another key issue, is that your frontal lobe can work. It just doesn't engage when it needs to. And the medications do help to turn on that frontal lobe function. And that's really important, because people sometimes feel that ADHD people are just purposefully trying to drive somebody crazy, or they're purposefully being passive aggressive or what have you, but they honestly are not engaging.
It's interesting. It seems counterintuitive, but stimulants generally are prescribed to deal with adult ADHD. If you both could talk about that, I find that it's kind of counterintuitive. I'm curious about why, how that works neurologically.
Well, if you think about the frontal lobe, right? The ways that we turn kind of engage the frontal lobe is that we kind of increase the availability of dopamine and norepinephrine. That's exactly what stimulants do. And in fact, the other medications that we also use for ADHD do the same thing. So it's kind of like walking into a dark room and turning on a light switch, but the switch isn't connected to the light. The medications help to make that connection. And it kind of depends on how much light you need in the room. But that's exactly what those medications do. So we call them stimulants, but their actual effect is that they're affecting these neurotransmitters that helps to engage that frontal lobe.
So David, to expand on Dr. Bryant's explanation here, there's a difference in the ADHD brain versus the neurotypical brain, the normal brain. And so for ADHD, where there's a deficit of dopamine, stimulants increase dopamine, increase motivation, increase thinking ability. However, if you give stimulants to a normal brain, you increase dopamine too much. And that's when you get activated and irritable and agitated, and your heart starts beating quickly. So there's a difference in the nature of the brain that accounts for the difference in how stimulants work in ADHD individuals as opposed to non-ADHD individuals.
It's fascinating. It's one of the most common disorders, yet there's no U.S. clinical practice guidelines for diagnosing and treating patients beyond childhood. If you could both talk about that, I mean, it seems, you know, rather bizarre. It's one of a major disorder in our society, and yet there's no at least U.S. clinical practice guidelines. If you could talk about that,
so I can speak to that. Specifically, I'm a principal involved in the development and eventual publication of these guidelines. The American Professional Society for ADHD and Related Disorders is a national organization represented by national and international experts. We've undertaken this process. It's a lengthy process, but when we do get it published, it'll be the first in the world that speaks to the diagnosis and treatment of ADHD in adults. We currently have international guidelines on ADHD, but most of that focus is on children and adolescents. It hasn't really focused on the research for adults. So we're looking, hopefully, for publication on this in 2025. And it is it's very enthusiastically awaited by patients, families, educators, clinicians, policymakers, federal agencies. Everybody is chomping at the bit waiting for this to come out. So we have clinical practice guidelines. That's exactly what it is. And that means that clinicians will be able to be trained consistently and deliver care in a standard way across the country, whether they're being seen in person or whether they're being seen on telehealth.
I would say also that as a child psychiatrist,
Dr. Brian, you know, your thoughts on this. I mean, you're on the ground, if you will.
As a child psychiatrist, that's my training. And so I end up taking care of a lot of adult patients with ADHD because many adult psychiatrists are not as familiar with the whole concept, where they have not had that much experience treating ADHD. And they don't have the experience necessarily with the medications to feel comfortable and to be able to, you know, really advise patients. So I think it is something that we need to add to adult training so that we can really reach these people. 25 to 30% of people with adult ADHD don't ever get it diagnosed. So it's important. And like I said, it's not cosmetic. It's not, sometimes I feel like our society thinks that, you know, we reach too quickly for drugs and that's the answer to everything. And that's not necessarily true. I mean, I think this is not, not arbitrary. We do need to treat these adults. The consequences for them are profound. Sometimes job loss, troubles with marriages, even automobile accidents. It's something that we really need to make sure remains available. And I'll say one more thing, which is that executive functioning, which is one of the key issues of ADHD, which is a difficult subject, doesn't respond as well as we would like to stimulant medications. So sometimes there are other things we have to do to help people to kind of coach themselves to stay organized and stay on top of things. But the stimulant medications can make a huge difference, as can others.
I think it's really important, and it's highly prevalent, relatively speaking, and not paid enough attention to. Maybe the whole, you could say, the whole society is ADHD. It sometimes feels like it. I should say that I'm speaking with Dr. David Goodman, an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And we're also joined by Dr. Beverly Bryan, staff psychiatrist at the online provider Takiak. Why don't you say it for me, Dr.
Bryan? Takiatry.
Takiatry.
I'm sorry.
Okay. We'll give you another opportunity at the end because I'll probably mangle it. So, I mean, one of the problems is that folks, you know, get misdiagnosed. They think they have ADHD, you know, adults do, and in fact, they don't. I mean, are you seeing that in your practices? Dr. Bryan, if you could speak to that, and then Dr. Goodman.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of patients that believe they've read criteria. They believe they have ADHD. They're seeking evaluation. But when you really actually look at it, their onset of symptomatology was later in life. They really weren't consistent with what you would expect for that childhood onset. But they are experiencing anxiety, depression, a lot of times trauma. Anxiety really wreaks havoc on attention. If you stop and think about it, you know, that kind of deer in headlights thing really wreaks havoc on your ability to pay attention, especially to detail. So one of the most important parts of the diagnosis is to tease out comorbidities or other diagnoses that may also explain ADHD. And for children, even for children, anxiety is underdiagnosed is actually more common than ADHD. And so it's very important to be able to tease out the differences between those two.
Your thoughts, Dr. Goodman?
David, you mentioned that ADHD in adults is one of the most common. Let me put some numbers on that. Major depression, which is clinical depression, occurs in the general population at about 7%. Adults with ADHD are at 4.5%. Generalized anxiety disorder is 3%. ADHD is one of the second most common psychiatric disorders in adults. And is that ADHD in adults was abdicated to child psychiatry. And what you notice is professional training folks.
Maybe the echo's from me. Hold on.
How's my?
Why don't you go ahead? It might have been me. Go ahead, folks. Dr. Goodman, you were saying?
ADHD in adults has been advocated by adult psychiatrists. Focus on training in adult psychiatry, PhD psychology programs, nurse practitioners. And so now we're all playing catch up in order to learn. The clinicians in the field are being trained with continuing medical education, and they've come up to speed, but we're still graduating a lot of young professionals who don't have formal training.
Does any one of my guests have their speakers on? We're getting an
echo. I'm trying to change my audio setting. How's that?
I've muted myself.
I have my cell phone off. I just have the computer on, dear engineer.
Why don't you go to Dr. Bryant and I'll see what I can do.
I don't know. Can you hear me any better, David?
Okay, we're going to take a little break, folks, just to figure out our engineering echo problem. We'll be right back with you. I'm so sorry.
This is your sister Kim Bay here with DJ Z Lion from Saturday Evening's Culture Shack.
WPFW presents the Equality and Justice Fundraising Concert with Proverbs Reggae Band.
Featuring your very own DJ Z Lion, aka Razaya Ayubu, and special guest songbird, the captivating Freedom in Saroma Lee L.
Sunday, July 7th, 2024. 4 to 8 p.m. live and direct at Mango African Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. Proverbs Reggae Band keeps it culturally clean, so rock and come in, kings and queens.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
And I'm Robin Holden. Join us for an unforgettable day of dancing, drinking, and great vibes at the Reggae Rhythms Fest. Feel the rhythm of the island beats and dance the day away in a celebration of good music and good times.
Whether you're a reggae aficionado or just looking for a fun day out, Reggae Rhythms Fest is the place to be. Bring your friends, bring your family, and let's make great memories together. This is a VIP event. Only 150 tickets available. Ticket price is $35. Food and beverage available for purchase.
Check Eventbrite. Search WPFW Reggae Fest. Come and join us Sunday, July 7th from 4 until 8 p.m. at the Mango Cafe.
The D.C. Black Fathers Matter Project, 5th Annual Father's Day Motorcade, Saturday, June 15th. The motorcade honoring black fathers will depart at 12 noon from the African American Civil War Museum at 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest. Arrival is as early as 10:30 a.m. to participate. The motorcade will end at the Big Chair on Martin Luther King Avenue and V Street Southeast at approximately 1 p.m. D.C. residents are encouraged to display banners or posters in your neighborhood, community, or church. Beginning Friday, June 14th, in honor of Black Fathers. More info at 202-240-1182. That's 202-240-1182 or dcblackhistory.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, June 29th, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are. June the 29th on Pennsylvania and 3rd.
WPFW's 2024 election to seat members to represent you on the local station board has started. Renew your membership by making a minimum donation of $25 or completing 3 hours of eligible volunteer work by June 30th in order to be a candidate, nominate candidates, or vote. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information or call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor.
All right, David, we're back.
Okay, and do you have Peter?
I'm on here, David.
You're on, okay. Last week marked the 80th anniversary of D-Day, the Allied invasion of Nazi-occupied France. D-Day was undeniably a heroic event. Almost 10,000 men lost their lives storming the beaches of Normandy. But there's a counter-narrative. Joining us to talk about that is Dr. Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University and the co-author, along with Oliver Stone, of The Untold History of the United States. It's a book. It's also a extraordinarily interesting TV series that you can find on Showtime. Dr. Peter Kuznick, welcome to Community Watch and Comment.
Hi, David. Be glad to be with you again.
It's great to be with you. And we would really welcome callers, despite our technical difficulty, 202-588-0893. Dr. Kuznick, D-Day was certainly notable. Largest naval invasion ever, if I understand correctly. But depicting it as turning the tide against the Nazis is a bit of a stretch, I think we can say. That happened over a year earlier in Stalingrad, a battle most Americans know little or nothing about. Please talk about Stalingrad.
Well, the fighting in Stalingrad actually began in August of 1942, and the battle didn't end until early February of 1943. That was the first big
I'm not hearing.
The D.C. Black Fathers Matter Project, 5th Annual Father's Day Motorcade, Saturday, June 15th. The motorcade honoring Black Fathers will depart at 12 noon from the African American Civil War Museum at 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest. Arrival is as early as 10:30 a.m. to participate. The motorcade will end at the Big Chair on Martin Luther King Avenue and V Street Southeast at approximately 1 p.m. D.C. residents are encouraged to display banners or posters in your neighborhood, community, or church beginning Friday, June 14th in honor of Black Fathers. More info at 202-240-1182. That's 202-240-1182. Or dcblackhistory.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Sorry, we lost you there. So if you could go back, just we're talking about the extraordinary battle at Stalingrad between the Russians, the Soviets, and the Nazis. If you could start over again, we lost you there.
David, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah.
Okay. As I was saying, that the Battle of Stalingrad actually began back in August of 1942 and was not concluded until early February of 1943. It was the first major defeat that the Germans suffered. They lost an enormous number of men, after which Hitler said, "The gods of war have gone over to the other side." And that was, and beginning then in early 43, the Soviets were on the offensive. It was followed up by the tremendous tank battle at Kursk, which again, there were heavy losses on both sides, but was a major victory for the Soviets. And then they broke the siege at Leningrad. The siege had gone on for 872 days. Was not broken until early January or late January 1944. Somewhere between 800,000 and 1.5 million Soviets died at Leningrad, including Vladimir Putin's older brother, who was 2 years old. Putin's father was severely wounded in defending Leningrad against the Nazis. So this has special resonance for Putin himself, who talked about it, especially on the 75th anniversary.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, can we say, so by D-Day, what is it, June 1944, the Soviets are well on the offensive, as you said. I mean, can we say that, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to speculate, but given what we know now, I mean, the Soviets probably would have beaten the Nazis even if we hadn't had a D-Day.
Well, yes, the Soviets were on the offensive. They were chasing the Nazis then across Central, Eastern Europe and Central Europe and marching toward Berlin. But the shouldn't downplay the American contribution. Because
right.
From the very beginning, the fear was when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, the fear was that the Soviets would cut a separate deal like they did in World War I and then be out of the war, and that the Brits and allies would have to fight it on their own. And so Roosevelt sent Harry Hopkins over to Moscow to meet with Stalin. You have to remember that initially the Soviets were caught off guard by this German invasion. It's very strange that Stalin, who didn't trust anybody, for some reason trusted Hitler when during the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact and was not prepared at all for the invasion. Stalin disappeared for a few days, was totally depressed, and the danger was that the Germans would immediately march on Moscow and take Moscow very quickly and lead to a likely Soviet surrender. But the Soviets resisted that early assault on Moscow. The winter set in, and then the American aid started to come. And what Roosevelt promised was a lot of materiel. And Stalin told Hopkins that if the U.S. provided the materiel, the Soviets could fight, they'd stay in the war for 2 or 3 years at least. And that's what happened. And so the Germans continued their assault the following year in 1942, but the Soviets were able to turn the tide. So the Roosevelt was able to maneuver to get the Soviet Union lend-lease aid, which was not easy given the hostility toward the Soviets in American society. There were some people who admired the Soviets, but the little admiration that they had was squandered by the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in 1939, the non-aggression pact. And so, but Roosevelt understood the importance of the Soviets as the bulwark against fascism. And the Soviet Union, to their credit, was the only country that wanted to stop Hitler earlier. When the French, the British, and others were appeasing Hitler, the Soviets wanted to stop Hitler militarily. When they realized that the West's strategy was not to stop Hitler, that there were many in the West who preferred to see Hitler actually encouraged so he would go after the Soviet Union, which is what Hitler lays out in Mein Kampf, his plan for going after the Soviet Union. And so knowing that, they did not stop the Nazis. And it's understandable why people didn't want to go to war after the horrors of World War One. However, by not stopping them, and then the German invasion of the Soviet Union, it looked like Germany might be able to conquer the Soviet Union and would then be in a position to go after England very, very effectively, because France had collapsed very quickly at the start of the war. And so Hitler was controlling much of Europe at the time. And it was the Soviets who resisted, the Soviets who turned the tide of the war.
I mean, the reason I wanted to have you on is just there's this complete absence of any discussion in the mainstream press that I've seen. I'm not reading everything, certainly, but there's no serious discussion about, you know, the Soviets are the ones that really, you know, countered Hitler. I mean, and there's this expression of, oh, D-Day turned the tide of the war, liberated Europe, and there's just no discussion about the deterrence that the Soviets provided. I mean, just if you could talk about the kill ratio, but, you know, we lost, what, 500,000 men? I mean, valiant fighters. I'm not in any way lessening the valor, the courage of the participants of D-Day and the soldiers in the war effort. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the Russians, the Soviets were, you know, very, very much responsible in large part for the defeat of the Nazis. If you could talk about the kill ratio and everything involved.
Yes, I mean, what you're saying is correct. We have to acknowledge that D-Day was heroic, that the Americans fought bravely, that it was historically significant, because it finally opened up a serious second front against Germany. Yeah, throughout most of the war, the Americans and the British were confronting 10 German divisions between us. The Soviets were confronting more than 200 German divisions. As Churchill said, it was the Red Army that tore the guts out of the Nazi war machine. The Germans lost approximately 1 million on the Western Front and 6 million on the Eastern Front. At least 80% of the German casualties were suffered fighting the Soviets. So this idea that the West or the United States and the Brits won the war is really nonsense, and people understood that at the time. The polling that I saw back from 2015 and other polls that I've seen show that now the overwhelming majority of Europeans think that the Americans or the Brits defeated Germany. Right now, the latest polling, 13% of the Europeans said that the Soviets played a major role in defeating Nazi Germany, 13%. In France, that number was down to 7%. But you have to remember that back in May of 1945, according to the polls, 57% of the French say the Soviets played not a major role, but the major role. Now that's down to 7%. In the United States, we've got the exact same historical amnesia. The Americans know nothing about what happened during World War II. nothing about Soviet heroism at the time. But at the during the war, Americans knew about that. It was the New York Times principal daily book reviewer, Orville Prescott, who wrote on June 22, 1942, the one-year anniversary of the German invasion of the Soviet Union. He wrote in the New York Times, quote, "The vast armaments, the fighting skill, and magnificent courage of the Red Army may prove to have been the decisive factor in the salvation of the human race from Nazi slavery. Our debt of gratitude to the millions of Russian soldiers who have fought and died in this war and who will continue to do so is beyond estimation or expression." And we have similar comments in the New York Times 2 months earlier by the Times journalist Ralph Parker, who wrote, "It would need a Tolstoy to describe the heroic endurance of the Soviet men and women who have made this defeat of Germany possible." So in 1942, we got it. 1944, 1945, we got it. But nowadays, people don't get it. Americans believe falsely that the United States won the war in Europe almost single-handedly. And if you look at the commemoration that just occurred last week in Normandy and other parts of France, there was no mention of the Soviets. The Russians were not invited. Putin wasn't there. It was all about American heroism and how bad the Russians are, terrible things the Russians are doing now in Europe. And if we don't stop them in Ukraine, they're going to take over the rest of Europe, is what Biden said in his famous speech there in Normandy. So this is the what we have then is this complete historical ignorance, which is, from my perspective, extremely dangerous. You know, as Zhou Enlai said mockingly at one point, the great Chinese leader, he said, "The delightful thing about Americans is that they have absolutely no historical memory." And that's sadly true.
Yep.
But to go on with the point you were making, you said that 500,000 Americans died in the war. Well, the actual figure is about 410,000, 300,000 perhaps in combat. What the Soviets suffered in World War II was not 400,000 dead. It was 27 million dead. As John Kennedy said in his famous AU commencement address, the greatest presidential address of the 20th century, John Kennedy said that what the Soviets suffered in World War II is the equivalent of the entire United States east of Chicago having been destroyed. And it's mind-boggling what happened to the Soviet Union. And we think of what happened on D-Day, this day of great American heroism that we rightly celebrate and commemorate. The Americans and the Brits and the other invading forces, and there were quite a few European countries involved in that, we lost 4,400 men on D-Day. 4,400 men. That was tragic.
Peter, I'm confused because the figure you hear is over 9,000, but you're saying it's half of that?
Well, on D-Day itself, it was 4,400.
Okay.
On D-Day,
you hear 9,000 something is talking about.
Well, the fighting went on for a few days afterwards.
Right, right.
But we commemorate D-Day itself. And
at the risk of being redundant, we're not in any way taking anything away from the courage of the men that landed
in
Normandy. And of course, I mean, it's just
they stormed those beaches. I mean, they risked their lives, and many of them never made it back, and many more were wounded. And you know, that's partly, it's so dramatic, it's part of the reason why it's the heart of almost every American World War II movie. It's because of the heroism of that day. And I don't deny that for a second. My, you know, we all know people who, families that lost people on that day. And it was very tragic. And it did help turn the tide of the war. I'm not downplaying the American contribution. Without the American materiel, the Soviets could have been defeated in 1941 and 42. Now, without, we finally opened up a second front. But I want to make two very important points. In 1942, Roosevelt writes to Churchill and says to people here that the Soviets are killing more Germans than the Americans and the British and everybody else combined. We have to give them support. So in May of 42, Roosevelt wrote to Stalin and asked him to send over Foreign Minister Molotov and a trusted general to Washington. And they met in Washington in late May 42 with Roosevelt and General Marshall. And at that meeting, Roosevelt turns to Marshall and says, can we open up the second front in Europe before the end of 1942? And Marshall says, absolutely. Eisenhower had already done studies. We were prepared to do that. And we pledged then to the Soviets we'd open up the second front before the end of 1942, which is exactly what the Soviets were hoping for. And in fact, you see the reports from prize-winning correspondent Leland Stowe, who said that if the second front was postponed beyond the end of 1942, he said that the disillusionment of the great mass of Russian people would be almost immeasurable. He said the present steadily mounting and invaluable cooperation between the Soviet, British, and American governments and leaders would suffer such a setback as to constitute diplomatically, materially, and psychologically a major disaster for the Allied cause. The U.S. ambassador in Moscow said that the postponing the Second Front would make the Russian people doubt the U.S. sincerity and do, quote, inestimable harm. But Churchill refused to go along with it, and he sabotaged it. He had his reasons, but they certainly were not credible to Stalin and the Russians, and the Second Front was postponed for a year and a half. By that point, the Soviets had done the heavy lifting.
I mean, Dr. Peter Kuznick, I should say, I'm speaking with Dr. Peter Kuznick, AU history professor, author, along with Oliver Stone, of the Untold History of the United States. So the major roadblock to a second front, which was Stalin and the Russians were on their knees begging us to do, you're saying the major impediment was Churchill, not the United States, because didn't Senator Truman on the floor of the Senate, you know, basically say we want them to, the Soviets and the Nazis, to knock each other off, and we can just wait and watch? Your thoughts about that?
Well, Truman was never Roosevelt. Truman was never Vice President Henry Wallace. I mean, Truman is now considered a near-great president. When he left office, his approval ratings were so low that the only one who's ever come close since was George W. Bush. So Truman is now considered, you know, some kind of great leader, but not at the time, not the people who knew him. Truman was not, a fraction of Franklin Roosevelt. And Truman says in December of 41, says if the Russians are winning, we support the Germans. If the Germans are winning, we support the Russians. And that way, let them kill as many of each other as possible. So with Roosevelt's last cable that he wrote before he died, he wrote a cable to Churchill, and he said, quote, I would minimize the general Soviet problem as much as possible, because these problems, in one form or another, seem to arise every day, and most of them straighten out. That was Roosevelt's last wisdom. He had no doubt that he and Stalin would remain friendly and that the Americans and the Soviets would remain allies after the war. But he dies on April 12, 1945, and then you get Harry Truman replacing him. You have to remember that the Democratic Convention in 1944, the day it began, July 20th, 1944, Gallup released a poll asking potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% of potential voters said they wanted Henry Wallace back as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. So in our great democracy, the question is, how do the party bosses maneuver this to get Truman on the ticket as vice president in 44, get Truman in office in 45 instead of Wallace? Had Wallace been vice president and then president when Roosevelt died, as Oliver Stone and I argue in Untold History, there would have definitely been no atomic bombings in World War II and almost certainly no Cold War. History would have been completely different. But we look at this question of America's historical amnesia that you and I were talking about before. And, you know, it is quite, quite dangerous. As the philosopher George Santayana, we know Santayana is the one who said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. But he also said, a country without memory is a country of madmen. And that's what allows us to do many of the things that we've done and continue to do. But if we look at, so I'm not downplaying the American heroism at Normandy, but with the fact that we lost 4,400 men on D-Day, you know what that means in comparative terms? If you compare this 27 million the Soviets lost to the 4,400 we lost on D-Day, the Soviet loss in World War II is the equivalent to one D-Day every day for 18 years. One D-Day every day for 18 years. It's the equivalent to one 9/11 every day for 24 years. It's the equivalent to one Pearl Harbor a day every day for 30 years. That's what the Soviet losses were. And so for the Americans or the Europeans to be claiming that they played the major role in defeating Germany is beyond absurd. It's obscene. It's a huge issue in Russia, but it's certainly not appreciated at all in the West. And when Biden goes there and makes his claims at Normandy, I mean, it just rings so hollow. There's something so disturbing that none of the real historical credit is given. And that's not to defend the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which I don't defend. But to distort this history is very, very dangerous. And it's something that we do constantly. And Americans don't. For example, I did an anonymous survey with college students, all of whom were A students in high school history classes. And I asked them how many Soviets died, how many Americans died in World War II? Anonymous survey. The median answer I got was 90,000. Okay, they're only 300,000 off. They're in the ballpark. I asked them how many Soviets died in World War II. The median answer I got was 100,000, which means they're only 27 million off, which means they have no idea what World War II is about. They have no idea what the Cold War is about. They have no idea what Ukraine is about. You might have seen the announcement earlier this morning, or last night really, that the United States is lifting the ban on military aid to the Azov Battalion, the Azov Brigades in Ukraine. These are the neo-Nazis. These are the ones who were the battalion was founded in 2014 by Andrei Beletsky. Beletsky was an open neo-Nazi. The brigades were heavily neo-Nazi. They use and still use neo-Nazi insignias and symbols. They're extreme right-wingers. The ones who are not neo-Nazis are ultra-nationalists. And for that reason, the U.S. had refused all along to allow any military aid or training or support for the Azov. They were called the Azov Battalion, then the Azov Brigade. Now they're part of the Ukrainian National Guard. But now, as of today, we've lifted that.
We've lifted that. It's like at every step of the way, Biden has is lifting restrictions. We're going to unfortunately have to end it here. I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University and co-author, along with Oliver Stone, of The Untold History of the United States, also available on Showtime. Thank you very much. We're going to have to get you back soon. It's just so fascinating and important to hear your perspective. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, David. You take care.
Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for the show. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll see you next week.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Hunter Biden, son of President Joe Biden, was found guilty this morning of three gun-related felony charges. The jury spent only about an hour deliberating yesterday after attorneys delivered closing arguments and spent another couple hours deliberating this morning. Defense lawyers argued Hunter Biden had been turning his life around when he purchased the gun in 2018, and that there was no evidence he was using drugs at the time. Prosecutors called several people close to Biden to testify, attempting to show he was still in the throes of a crack addiction when he bought the gun. Federal law prohibits people from owning guns and using drugs at the same time, and Hunter Biden had filled out a form attesting he was not using drugs at the time of the purchase. He faces up to 25 years in prison, but as a first-time offender, would likely not be sentenced to the maximum penalty if he is found guilty. The judge has not yet set a sentencing date. Imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier sat for his first full parole hearing in 15 years yesterday, a high-stakes moment for Peltier and the movement to free him. Peltier has been jailed since 1977, when he was convicted of involvement in the killing of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation. He has been steadfast in declaring his innocence, and a wide array of politicians and humanitarian groups have called for his parole or release. The FBI has vehemently opposed Peltier's release from prison. A decision on Peltier's parole is expected in 21 days. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor called today for further information into a deadly hospital raid in the western Darfur region of Sudan, calling it a, quote, systematic and a profound attack on human dignity. Sudan has been engulfed in civil conflict for over a year, with intense fighting between the military and a rival paramilitary group consuming the capital Khartoum and the rest of Darfur region, where a genocide was perpetrated beginning in 2003. The hospital raid by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces targeted